Hey everyone, and welcome to this, a Snake Oilers edition of the Risky Business Podcast. My name's Patrick Gray. This isn't the weekly news show that we publish here at Risky.biz. This is something else, a wholly sponsored podcast that features vendors talking about their tech. Everyone who appears in these Snake Oilers podcasts paid to be here. If you're looking for the weekly show, just scroll back one episode in your podcast player. But at this point, I kind of want to break protocol a little and talk about our process in putting these Snake Oilers podcasts together. These days, Risky Biz gets a lot of inbound inquiries from vendors who are chasing sponsorship packages. We have over 600 security vendors in our CRM database, and most of them are there because they inquired about sponsoring. They reached out to us. But in the end, we wind up doing business with about 20 to 25 vendors in any given calendar year. So this is my way of saying we don't just accept any sponsor who comes along. Now, does this mean that we endorse any of the vendors we feature in these sponsored segments? No, it doesn't. I mean, I'm not a practitioner. I can't tell you, these guys are fantastic, guaranteed. But we generally select vendors for Snake Oilers who we think are doing interesting things. Vendors who we think will give us an interesting and relevant conversation for the audience about what they're doing and why. And that's really what these podcasts are about. That's the process explainer out of the way. So let me tell you about what's going to be in this edition of Snake Oilers. In this podcast, you are going to hear from three vendors. First up, we'll hear from industry luminary Richard Baitlick, who is working currently with CoreLite. CoreLite offer products based on Zeek, which used to be known as Bro. But that's a super cool chat with Richard. And I let it run long because it's Richard Baitlick. Come on, right? So that one actually runs a little bit longer than the interviews in Oilers normally do. Then we're going to hear from Marshall Webb from Path Networks. And that's also a really great interview, that one. Marshall will be telling us about eBPF and XDP, two technologies, open source technologies, that are really pushing the state of the art in DDoS mitigation forward. Basically, these two things now mean that you can efficiently mitigate DDoS attacks with commodity hardware. So Path has built a business around that. And by the looks of things, they're going after those Arbor Networks-based services. They've already got a terabit per second of connectivity, which is a lot of bits per second for a relatively new company. But yeah, their idea is that DDoS scrubbing and standby DDoS scrubbing services shouldn't cost a fortune. It's kind of a tax on business. And they're using the latest standards and the latest techniques to mitigate these attacks using commodity hardware, and they're passing on the savings to customers. They've also built some really cool distributed network monitoring tools as well. So there's a lot going on in that interview. That is number two this time. And then our last Snake Oiler for this edition is Respond Software. They make a decision agent for SOCs, basically. But I guess that's kind of underselling it a bit. They're quite literally aiming to replace frontline SOC analysts with software. Now, the funny thing is, right, you might think, oh, that sounds a bit risky, but say this out loud. We can't use a software agent for first-line monitoring because we might miss something. So yeah, when you say it out loud, it's kind of funny, right? Because everybody's already missing stuff. Respond's whole pitch is that they can bump out a list of like five serious things your SOC should be doing that day instead of trawling through tens of thousands of meaningless, contextless alerts. And when you're finished with those five confirmed serious things, hey, you can always go back and look at your logs. But as you'll hear, Respond's customers are actually starting to really trust it to do that first piece of analysis. So that is also an interesting chat. We got a bunch of stuff, a great bunch of stuff to talk through in this edition. So let's kick it off now with our chat with Richard Baitlick, who has previously appeared a few times as a feature guest on this podcast. I think you can really describe Richard as an industry luminary. He's been in the discipline since the 90s. He's written a bunch of books, so on and so on. And these days he is with CoreLite. Their goal is to transform network traffic into actionable data for analysis, forensics, and real-time response. Their product is based on the open source tool Zeek, which was formerly Bro. And Richard joined me to talk about it. And here's what he had to say.
If you think about a spectrum of what you can learn about your network, at one end of the spectrum, you've got write everything to disk, and that's a full content PCAP collection. At the other end of the spectrum, you have tell me as best as you can just the things that I want to know that might be good or bad, or however you define, if you want to have policy violations or whatever you call it. Now, you could think of, you know, going back to the full PCAP, that's great, but even in an era of inexpensive storage, how are you going to make use of that data on a daily basis? At the other end, the alerts, well, what if you miss something? What if you don't have an alert for whatever the attack du jour is? So Zeek sits right in the middle of that. And the idea behind it is to give you an idea of what's happening on a network in a form that has enough detail that you can make some sense of it, but not so much that it just takes up a lot of space and it's tough to index and all that. It's a pretty simple idea, but it turns out that there really aren't many products or offerings in that space. Like the thing that we always get, you know, CoreLite gets compared to quite often is NetFlow. But NetFlow, for the most part, is just a description of who talked to who, when, how much data was passed, you know, IPs, protocols, that sort of thing. And we'll give you that with our connection log, but then any protocol that Zeek understands, we're going to give you data about that as well. So let's say that you've got a TCP connection, and on top of that is an HTTPS session. We're going to give you what we can from HTTPS, which will end up being SSL data. So we'll give you server names, and we'll tell you information about the certificates. And if you want, we can extract the certificates, and you can save that to disk. And all of this is linked through connection IDs, so that, or UIDs as they appear in the logs, so that if you're trying to figure out what relates to what, you're trying to do, like, you know, your data science or whatever you want to call it on that information, it makes it easy to follow that chain. And as it turns out, that's a really nice place to be if you're trying to understand what's happening on your network, because we answer a lot of the questions that a security person wants to know in a small footprint that can be saved for, you know, basically forever. If you think about having some type of hot storage that goes into a database or Splunk or Humio or Google Chronicle or whatever, and if you want to do cold storage, you know, just writing text files to disk or you know, gzipped files to disk and put it up in Amazon Glacier or something forever. So that's the basic idea, and we can expand beyond that, I'm sure.
Yeah, it kind of reminds me a little bit, like it's similar to what the team at Iceberg did. That they were a small company, wound up being acquired by Gigamon. Their stuff was a bit different in that it streamed everything to the cloud, and it was very much about metadata. But what I found interesting about them, and what I find interesting about CoreLite, is that here we are in 2019, when apparently, you know, network monitoring is dead, and yet you exist, right? And people are buying your stuff. So do you think the death of network, you know, security monitoring has maybe been called a bit prematurely?
Yeah, I actually wrote a blog post early on at CoreLite, and the marketing team labeled it NSM is dead. And at first I was a little shocked, like, oh no, this is great. This is going to get around that I think NSM is dead. But it ended up just being a clickbait, I suppose, so people would read the post.
NSM is dead, long live NSM.
Exactly, thing, right? Yeah. So there's no doubt that it is not the same world as it was when I started in 1997, 1998. Back then, if you saw something on the wire, it was generally unencrypted. And when it was a non-binary protocol, so let's say it was not Sun Remote Procedure Call or something like that, it was generally text, so you could read it. So if it was simple HTTP, you could read the page and see what it's doing. If it was a file transfer over FTP, you could read the commands. And if it was Telnet, you could read the administrator or a criminal interacting with your system. And that was a great way to figure out what was happening, because it was just right there. You know, fast forward to the last 10 years or so, and more traffic is encrypted. You can't do that anymore.
Well, now, it did kind of make a lot of the full packet capture stuff that was very trendy, like, you know, NetWitness. There was another one. What was it called? It was the one that got sold to Arbor. But that stuff was super hip for a while, and then everything started getting encrypted. And it's like, yay, look at all these captured packets we've got that we can't read. You know, similar sort of problem.
Yeah. Well, so there's an interesting workflow to that. So the workflow of many of the full packet vendors, particularly a company like NetWitness, was around network forensics. And it was a similar approach that you would take with file-based forensics. Imagine you have a disk, you want to extract all the artifacts, render them in a way that an analyst can look through them. And when they find the stolen invoice, they say, aha, that person's not supposed to have that on the computer. The way that the network forensic vendors took it was the traffic that was captured during a certain period was essentially the hard disk. They would extract all the artifacts and present them to the analyst. That is generally not the same kind of workflow, though, that we've seen develop in the era of the modern SOC and the rise of SIMs. Generally, what you find people doing is threat hunting, right? That's became popular for the last 9-10 years or so. It's looking for something that you didn't necessarily know was bad. And because of that, you don't need to have every Word document that was transferred on the wire to you ready for
100%, right? And this focus on looking at what's related, which connection came from what other connection and whatever. And what I've noticed too, right, is you've got this new breed of security vendor that's coming up at the moment where they've clearly had a lot of design. There's clearly been a lot of design influence from people who've worked in incident response. And I'm thinking in that case, like companies like AlphaSock, right, which is Chris McNabb, who was an incident responder who's doing stuff like real-time domain analytics and IP analytics and things like that. Mm-hmm. CoreLite's another one. I had another one in my head, but it's not quite there anymore. But yeah, I'm definitely seeing that fusion between people who worked in incident response now saying, well, hang on, if we had been looking for this more at the time, you know, we might have had a better shot at detection here.
Yeah. Yeah. And that brings up a really interesting point. When you buy our product, there is an interface, but it's essentially a sensor management health and welfare interface. Now, there may be some additional things coming to that I've been encouraging and helping develop at CoreLite. But for the most part, our product is built on giving you the data. We don't want to be another pane of glass that you have to monitor and somehow integrate into your workflow. So, initially I thought, this is going to be kind of difficult perhaps to sell to customers because they want to see the data. But it turns out at this point in the market, everybody's got a place for the data to go, right? They already have their Splunk infrastructure, or the market honestly is being disrupted very heavily, I think, by companies like Backstory or companies like Chronicle within Google with their Backstory product. People are seeing that you can do a lot with just really good high fidelity data, whether it's from the host or in our case, it's from the network through CoreLite and Zeek. So we don't sell you a pane of glass. We give you good data that helps you understand what's happening. And as a result of that, our stuff appears in many locations. And I should mention as well, we do support the open source product Zeek. We don't have like a Zeek for commercial and Zeek for open source. It's the same code. It's just that we do quite a bit with the data before it leaves the sensor and things like data reduction. So that, for example, maybe you don't want all the fields in the connection log, or you don't want all the fields in the DNS log, or if you're going into a Splunk environment and you just don't want to keep adding to your Splunk bill, we can help you select just the fields that you want to send. And as a result, you pay, customers who choose to go down that route pay like a third less than they might have if they were just sending open source Zeek logs to their SIM.
Okay, so it sounds like, and that's an interesting idea, right? Allowing you to tune it so you don't get hammered by Splunk license fees, right? Like that's kind of what I picked up there. Is that right?
That's exactly right. I had all you can eat Splunk license at GE, so it wasn't even an issue. We just dumped everything into it and just kept paying for more disk. But those days are pretty much over. In the modern world, you have to pay licenses. Now, what's really cool about Chronicle, and this isn't supposed to be an advertisement for them, but they have a per user model. So rather than a volume based model, they'll take everything you send to the system. So that, to me, that's really pretty exciting because what it results in is we've got people who they have certain workflows about how they're trying to respond to intrusions or trying to find intrusions or even troubleshoot problems. And they want to have the same type of data no matter where they're looking. If they're looking on premise, they want to have a certain type of network data. If they're looking in their cloud infrastructure, they want that. So that's one of the reasons why we started with a hardware appliance, but now we have these software offerings. So, again, if you just have your own virtual infrastructure at your company, we have a software, for VMware and that sort of thing. And then just in June, we released the AMI version that can go up in Amazon AWS. So, because people want to say, look, I've got a workflow. I want to be able to see my CoreLite data no matter where it is. I don't feel like I'm getting enough of the data in the right format that I like. from the native tools. So what can you guys do about it? And, you know, thankfully AWS introduced their virtual tap that makes that that traffic available to our sensor.
So, I mean, what it sounds like you're pitching here, if you boil it down to its simplest terms, is it is, you know, what you feel is a very high quality network information sensor that strips out the relevant information and can put it, you know, can plug it into your existing SIEM gear, can plug it into your existing sort of, you know, pane of glass. And that's going to be useful for things like threat hunting, perhaps detection if you put some rules about that higher up, and certainly for things like incident response.
Yes, and what you've so nicely or nicely summarized that, but that is only the foundation. So if you get CoreLight and you just put it in your environment, you get all of that. But the nice thing about CoreLight is that because it's running Zeek, you know, it is actually running Zeek. It's not running something that just looks like Zeek or whatever, because there's plenty of those out in the marketplace. But you get that Turing complete language underneath. So you can introduce your own packages. You can alter the way the code works. You can change the way our product works without having to have something on the roadmap. You know, I can't tell you how many vendors I used to work with where you'd say, well, are you ever going to have this feature? Yeah, that's coming out in quarter two of 2 years from now or whatever. And it would never arrive. When you have someone introduce a new capability in Zeek, like we just ran a package contest, or we sponsored a package contest for Zeek, there's new packages that are going to be announced at Zeek Week in October up in, is it Seattle or Portland? I can't remember, somewhere in the Pacific Northwest of the US. But these are new capabilities that have just been introduced by the open source community. And if you like the way they work, you can add them. If you want to modify them, you can do that. So I like to think of network appliances or network sensors built on open source as being sort of a beachhead. You know, you can take the beach, you can enjoy the beach and maybe stay there. But if you want to go farther inland, you can, because you have this the power of this open source engine underneath that could be modified by your own users.
I guess the last question here would be about deployment. I'm presuming that most organizations who use this, it's something that they put at the gateway on a mirror, you know, on a SPAN port, right? It's not something that they're putting everywhere internally.
Yeah, most people, and this is the way I would generally advise it. If you're in a legacy environment, you want to instrument all your gateways. So all the ways in or out of your environment, you know, the area that you're responsible for, at a minimum, I would instrument those gateways. The next place to go, you know, people call that a north-south deployment. The next place to go would be, again, if you're talking, say, of a big network, you're going to have sort of critical routers, interior locations where a lot of traffic gets passed within the environment. That's typically called east-west. So you'd want to deploy some sensors within that east-west environment. And then the final place, if we're talking about a, you know, on-premise enterprise environment, I'd like to go near critical infrastructure. So if you have, like, this is our R&D network, we want to really make sure we know who's using it, I would put a sensor there. Now, beyond that, we have the virtual sensors as well that you can put up in the cloud. So we have people who are looking to deploy our sensor up into Amazon. And honestly, I'm really looking forward to seeing how that goes and what people are finding, because it's a whole new world up there.
So I'm guessing really the call to action, as they say in marketing speak, for anyone listening to this is, you know, if you do have a SIM and you feel like you're not getting the type of raw network visibility that you want, I mean, that's your ideal customer at this point, right?
Yeah. And you know what? I did a blog post just the other day addressing the issue of, well, if you don't have a SIM, should you wait? Because we had some customers who said, well, we're reevaluating our SIM. We want to make sure it works with the new version of CoreLight. You know, obviously it's self-serving to say this, but you don't need to wait. There are many environments where you could just write the output to disk and you just load it into the SIM later. And even if you don't even look at that data over the month or 2 months or whatever,
it's handy to have it.
Oh, absolutely. That's one of the only times I've disagreed with Marcus Random. He used to be very famous for saying, don't collect logs you never look at. And I said, no, you collect those things because disk is cheap. And later on, when you find out you're owned or you suspect that you're owned, you go back and you look at all that stuff.
I think Marcus, I think he would be sort of more railing against the people who are just storing stuff like in a completely unstructured way. I mean, this at least has some rhyme and reason to it, right?
Yeah, that's true. I mean, I see where you're coming from. And yeah, our data, that is probably the biggest strength of it, is that it is linked by those UIDs. And If you ever want to like look at an open source project that was designed by like real smart people, like Vern Paxson invented this thing back in 1995, if you can imagine it. So it's a 24-year-old open source project. The quality of the engineering and the thought that went into it is really remarkable. It's amazing that the code has performed so well over the years and can do all these sorts of things. And it's also not, you know, it's optimized for the network, but at the end of the day, it's basically an event engine. So there is code out there that will take in OS query event data, treat it as an event, and you can have OS query data right alongside network data. So that's kind of the future of where things are going, I think, is you'll have more of this sort of unified logging where you're pairing information from an API call or from a host-based product with a network, so that you don't even have to do it in the SIM. It'll all come out of the event engine in Zeek and then go into your SIM if you want to put it there.
Well, Richard Baitlick, it's great to have you back on the show. I believe you were on once or twice before, like quite some time ago now, but it's been very good to chat to you. And thanks a lot for walking us through, I guess, what you're working on over there at CoreLite.
You're welcome. It was always nice to talk to a friend again. And thank you to anyone who was listening.
That was Richard Baitlick of CoreLite there. Big thanks to him for that. And you can find CoreLite at CoreLite.com. CoreLight.com. And I can totally see that their stuff would be worth taking for a spin. I mean, it's easy to deploy. So just give it a go. See what it's like. Let me know, right? Okay, on to our next snake oiler now, Path Networks. Path is doing some very interesting stuff with eBPF and XDP. I'll just do a quick explainer, but he explains it better in the actual interview. A quick example of like XDP. What that allows you to do is to push network rules to your commodity SmartNIC network cards. And that means that the routing decisions aren't being made by the host OS. They're not even hitting the OS kernel. They're being made on the actual NIC. And the obvious benefit to that is speed, a lot of speed. And in fact, you can now use XDP to build very effective DDoS filtering equipment that's competitive against expensive specialist hardware. And you can do that, on commodity hardware. Our next guest, Marshall Webb, a founder of Path, has seen a market opportunity to provide DDoS protection failover to a market that's kind of being extorted a little bit by the incumbent players. Not all of them, but some of them. Path offers these DDoS mitigation services to customers at a pretty substantially reduced cost compared to the incumbents. And they also don't try to screw new customers who are under attack and need the situation resolved quickly. They get them back online first, and then they talk turkey and contract later, which is sadly not how it works with some of these other companies. They also offer a really interesting network monitoring service. It's actually pretty clever the way they've done that. They trade access to their VPN service to people who are willing to run their network test agent on their personal mobile devices. And the end result is that Path has some pretty amazing visibility from a whole bunch of different places around the world. It's kind of a bit like the old Ripe Atlas network visibility stuff, but with a modern twist, being those mobile devices are the thing being used. It's not a dedicated hardware appliance anymore. Path also offers security consulting too. They've found once they start doing business with new customers, that's something they want from them. Marshall Webb joined me to talk about Path Networks, and I started off by asking him to explain what XDP actually is, and here's what he had to say.
Yeah, so XDP, Express Data Pathway, XDP is basically a new technology that's been able to be adopted by the Linux community and embedded in the new modern Linux kernel. What XDP allows us to do is push custom rules and rule sets directly to SmartNICs and different vendors who support SmartNIC technology, such as Mellanox and others. We're able to leverage these commodity network cards in our mitigation devices and then leverage them to push different rules and filters directly onto the network cards that we use in our devices. So this definitely greatly expedites the way that we're able to filter different DDoS stacks out. We're able to do things closer to line rate on our network cards, which is important as most of our filtering is based around 100 gigabit Ethernet. So having those fast speeds is very, very important to us. And we, every second counts when we're trying to mitigate an attack.
And eBPF is, I mean, it's not quite the same thing, but it's something else. It's another technology that allows you to sort of optimize for DDoS mitigation, right?
Exactly, exactly. So Berkeley packet filtering is a fairly older technology. I mean, everyone who's ever used IP tables or PF on BSD has interacted with it in some way. And what Berkeley packet filters have always allowed us to do is build those nice rules that we like to use to protect our equipment. But what eBPF has done is it's provide a very easy pipeline to work with XDP, and as we stated before, push those rules directly onto the silicon and get them out of the way so that we don't have to abstract that and have the OS deal with it.
You got a blog post on this stuff that you wrote up in April, and there's a line in it I really like, which is, you feel sometimes like you're cutting yourself on the bleeding edge, which, you know, I've known other people in that situation before, because, okay, these technologies exist, that's great, but getting them to work at a, you know, in a reliable way, there's a little bit of expertise involved there.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So a lot of what we've ran into is that, you know, with this technology coming out, with it being so new, you know, there was a litany of prior technologies that kind of paved the way to this, you know, PFRing, zero copy, NetMap. Over time, we had DPDK, but fortunately, we kind of, you know, we put our money on the winning horse, and fortunately, XDP kind of pulled away and became the standard. So now that's been adopted by, you know, by the Linux kernel, it's definitely, you know, greatly enhance the support that it has, and it's made it much, much easier to work with it in terms of commodity gear. So, so what we kind of refer to that is the lack of any sort of existing applications, you know, prior art that we can refer to. You know, there's not a lot of code online, obviously, with something as new as this. It's hard to pull in information that, you know, you might see with something that's a little bit older. And as a result, we've kind of had to trailblaze a little bit in that aspect. So, you know, the value of all the equipment, you know, obviously buying commodity gear definitely helps us out in terms of our margins. A lot of the effort was expended around getting the code bases together, working through different, you know, bugs or issues with the somewhat nascent, you know, XDP code base, and then putting all that together into a solution. So that's kind of what we refer to when we say that. And then obviously, you know, there's other technologies that kind of play a role in our stack that we've had to fight with. We're actually the maintainer of the S-Flow codec that's used by ELK. We maintain that code base, and we were actually given ownership of it just due to all the various patches that we submitted to kind of bring it up to speed. So
that's it. Hey, if someone comes along and starts submitting patches and maintaining it, it's like, hey, do you want this to be yours? That makes a lot of sense, right?
Exactly.
Please take
exactly.
It. It's fine. Yeah.
It allows us to give back a little bit. You know, we're allowed to, you know, we're enabled to, you know, contribute to it and help, you know, help everyone else at the same time. So
that makes a lot of sense. So look, at the end of the day, right, what this means is that you've effectively figured out how to use these open source technologies, this open source software, to engineer DDoS mitigation equipment that runs on commodity hardware. I mean, the TLDR is that's one big part of what PATH does, right?
Exactly. That's correct.
Yeah. So you've got customers. I believe you've got some ISPs and hosting companies using this stuff. One of your public customers is Cable Bahamas, which makes a lot of sense, right? Because those island nations are particularly vulnerable to DDoS stuff. So, you know, how do you deploy to your customers? Is this something where, you know, you're upstream from them and their providers? Is that's where your gear is installed? Or are you doing this as a cloud-based filtering? Is it always on? Is it just configured in a failover mode? Like, how are you actually taking this to market?
Yeah, that's a great question. So to answer your questions, the biggest way that we deploy this is typically in a on-demand type solution. So obviously DDoS comes in a few flavors in terms of packaging up mitigation solutions. You have always on, you have on-demand, and then you have, you know, some sort of hybrid solution that does a little bit of both. So in our case, what we see most clients tend to prefer, especially those in the hosting or the ISP space, where latency is always going to be very, very important, we try to keep it an on-demand solution. So the way that works is they'll typically configure their edge network to export flows to us, typically sample flows. So either S-Flow or NetFlow with a bit of sampling on it. But we're pretty agnostic in terms of what we can adjust, IP fix as well, and take in. And then based on the flow information that we get, we analyze it, we store it, we manage the historicity on it. And then if we detect any anomalies, we know that's when we need to do an advertisement cut over. So at that point, we'll send out a community string and then trigger policy-based routing to make sure that they announce those prefixes over to us. And at that time, we'll start to scrub and kick the clean traffic back. Typically, we'll do this over jury tunnels, but we can also do it via physical interconnection or an MPLS circuit.
Now, for a company that I'm guessing most of our listeners haven't heard of, like, you've got a lot of gigabits. Like, what's the capacity that you've actually got? Like, because it's a lot.
Yeah. So our current edge network capacity is touching on about a terabit per second when you take into the internet exchange ports and stuff that we have. So we're currently at Equinix LA1, Equinix NY9, and Equinix AM7 in Amsterdam. So we have three points of presence in total currently, and then we partner with Cogent, NTT, and Telia for bandwidth.
Now, I know one of your strategies going to market with this is to say, look, we're using commodity hardware, we're using open source technology. This isn't like an Arbor Networks situation where we've got a lot of R&D costs to recoup from, you know, things like specialist silicon and whatever like that. That's the old game. This is the new game. So one of the, you know, the big sort of marketing points from you is that, like, you're actually a lot cheaper, right? And in addition to that, you don't gouge and have special pricing for people who are currently under attack, right? Which is something that various upstream companies have been known to do from time to time.
Exactly. Our goal is to keep people online, shore things up, and then, you know, worry about that, you know, at a later point. So, you know, we try to build our business around that and our branding, and we definitely have much better margins in terms of how we've developed our stack and just having a modern stack. We caught things at a pretty good times in terms of technology. You know, 100 gig Ethernet becoming affordable, you know, XDP come to market, and the, you know, the commoditization of smart network cards. And we've been able to kind of use this formula to really cut down what, you know, the costs traditionally are in this space.
Do you typically sign people up on like a rolling standby contract sort of thing? Is that kind of how that works?
We still aim for long-term contracts. We still aim for three-year contracts, but we're much more flexible about the onboarding process in terms of if somebody is immediately getting attacked, we'll usually onboard them first and then worry about working out a contract later. You know, the main goal is just to help people get through the immediate attacks or whatever the immediacy is.
Without trying to squeeze them into a contract signed with blood.
Exactly.
Yeah. So, look, I mean, this isn't the only thing that you do, right? There is also the network monitoring stuff. And I think this is really cool because, like, you've actually managed to build up a pretty decent network of clients out there that can run tests for you, right? So you've got a pretty decent analytics business based off that.
Yeah, exactly. So we have both passive and active analytics. So to provide some more context around that, our passive analytics are obviously all flow-based. A lot of that's just, you know, remote exportation, you know, from edge networks where they'll, you know, a company will configure their devices to send that over to us. But then the other crux of what we do is the active analytics. The active analytics are different because we've basically taken a approach similar to Ripe Atlas, except in software. You know, Ripe Atlas had a hardware agent that you could deploy at your place of business or in your home that, you know, if you participated in the network, you could, you know, join the walled garden. And we took that similar model and kind of tweaked it. We developed a software agent that runs on mobile phones. Obviously, as people walk around or travel about their day-to-day business, they'll connect to a lot of different hotspots or networks. And as a result, we glean insight into all of those. We'll launch probes, MTRs, trace routes, you know, even layer 7 health checks from those devices. And because of the geographic dispersion of them, it constitutes a pretty good insight into how different ASNs are seeing certain traffic on the internet. So what this allows us to do is basically paint a portrait for our clients of routing. We can monitor route propagation. We can monitor SLA enforcement. We can measure latency or packet loss on different interfaces that they may be paired up with. And in doing so, from all these different ASNs, we can really get a good picture of any kind of anomalies that take place. This is very valuable if you're doing any kind of anycasting or if you're a multi-home network, which most tend to be now that things have scaled up on the internet. And that's pretty important. So having analytics that kind of keep up with the way the internet's going is kind of what we were shooting for. And then obviously as a mitigation company, we kind of built this, you know, really the server ourselves first. We wanted to basically have better insight into how we could measure the unicasting that we have, looking for route imbalances and other things like that. And this was the best way we could figure out how to do it. And then once we built it for ourselves, we decided to go to market with it, and we've had a lot of interest in it.
All right, so Marshall Webb, I guess, you know, what do you want the listeners to do here? I guess you're most interested in hearing from people who are, you know, hosting, who are running telcos. That seems to be the core group of customers there. I'm guessing you want to hear from them.
Yeah, I think the biggest thing that we want to see is just if they have any desire around, you know, improving the analytics that they can see inside their network, or if they have any issues with DDoS attacks, or if they're in need of mitigation, or if they're looking at that big Arbor contract and trying to make a decision, then I would hope that they would put us into consideration and see if we could, you know, help them out or give them at least another option.
All right, so people can find more information on Path Networks at path.net. I'm going to drop a couple of links into the show notes for this podcast, including to that blog post about eBPF and XDP. But Marshall Webb, it's been a pleasure to chat to you, my friend. And look, best of luck with it, because I think, you know, this business segment that you're playing in, it has got a little bit stale. So it's really great to see some people jumping in with a lot of obvious energy to try to shake things up a bit, and I hope it goes well.
Yeah, we're here living it up. Awesome. Patrick, thank you so much.
That was Marshall Webb there from Path Networks, and you can find them at path.net, which is a killer domain name, I think. And yeah, I think this is, you know, DDoS mitigation market. It is a market that has been due for a shakeup for quite a while, so it's immensely satisfying to see some moves in that direction. It's one thing for the technology to do this easily to exist. It's another thing for a company like Path to actually go out there and start doing stuff with it and, you know, ironing out all of those bugs. So good job, Path. Okay, up next is our third and final snake oiler for this edition, Respond Software. Now, we did a great soapbox edition with Respond about a year ago where they explained the basic thinking behind their product. I will link through to that in our show notes for this episode. Oh, and I'll just say that Respond came to Risky Biz by way of a referral from someone I know and respect who absolutely loves their software. But yeah, the whole idea is Respond offers a decision engine that can replicate so much of the grunt work that takes place in a modern SOC. Anyone who runs a SOC knows how hard it is keeping up with alerts and how much of that first touch work is just mind-numbingly boring. And the sad thing is analysts often miss serious stuff and wind up chasing dud issues and wasting a bunch of time, right? So there are real efficiency problems there. So the team at Respond Software have developed a decision engine that's designed to replace those level one SOC operators entirely. Now, some people will be skeptical about that. They'll think, you know, how can you trust a software agent? But our next guest, Respond VP Chris Triolo, says that's kind of what's happening naturally. People are buying Respond to sort of augment their decision making, and then they're just going, okay, look, it's clearly doing a good job, so we're just going to rely on that now, right? So that's kind of interesting. They call it, and it's a very American way to put things, but they call it their customer's trust journey. So there you go. Anyway, here's what Chris had to say about what Respond customers are up to these days.
They're spending less time monitoring in their, you know, their SIM. They're not spending hours and hours a day looking at all the alerts. They're waiting for the Respond analyst to pop out alerts. And this has been very significant for us, right? To see this change as customers are essentially on a trust journey with us, because as you move away from a human analyst in a human role, there's obviously going to be skepticism around that for everybody, right? And just whether it's in the security industry or any industry that we're in. So as we see, you know, that change happening, it's getting really exciting, you know, for us and I think for our customers.
There's a few different approaches to that problem of like trying to get, you know, SOC operators away from doing dumb stuff all the time, right? And this is one of them. Yeah. And by the sounds of things, it's you know, things that's quite effective. And I also believe, right, with something like Respond, look, what was the statistic that we used in the last recording we did with you that, 2 billion events got crunched down to 350 alerts, right? So that's, you know, that's an excellent start. It seems to me like, you know, everything that you're going to be flagging is going to be real. So maybe even if you, even if it feels like you don't even have to make the claim that it's comprehensive and flagging everything, because at least you know whatever it does flag is real, and that's a good starting point. Is that kind of the way customers are looking at this, and is that how they're taking that sort of trust leap?
Yeah, I believe so, because they're not giving up on their SIMs, right? They're not throwing their SIMs out or whatever else they were using up to this point. So it's not this sort of rip and replace. It's actually sort of a better together story, right? How do you bring in additional technology that has great detection logic that none of the other tech is doing, a new approach, you know, to it? And so it's additive in this case, right? And so we're seeing customers bring it in that way. And then, you know, eventually as the trust builds, they're able to start to make some tougher decisions that they might not have chose up front, right? A tough decision might be, you know, moving away from their MSSP, right? And relying on Respond Analysts to do that monitoring piece. You know, not the security device management that MSSPs provide. You know, it's a great service that, you know, that they would offer, but the monitoring piece where they can offload it, you know, to the analyst. And, you know, that's a pretty dramatic change for a customer to make. And we're seeing those kinds of things, but only over time. It is definitely sort of an additive approach up front.
Yeah, I think the MSSP people listening to this will probably not like me saying this, but it, you know, that type of service, log monitoring at an MSSP, has kind of been a compliance checkbox for a long time, and no one's really expected to get any value out of it. I mean, you know, the famous case of the Target hack, where there was a SOC person who actually flagged that. Out of some FireEye kit, it was a FireEye alert, and then, you know, just no one kind of took it seriously because it was lost in a deluge of other alerts, right? I mean, that's really the problem you're trying to solve here.
Yeah, we would love to see MSSPs take up our technology. We think anyone who's doing tier one, SOC level one analysis, they should be automating it, right? And now these tools are starting to be available, and they should leverage them. And what MSSPs could do, right, is offload that even in their own operation and then focusing on that higher value service for their customers, whether that's, you know, threat hunting, people are looking for managed threat hunting type services, deeper investigation, you know, IR services to help them through a breach when the breach is occurring. These are things that MSSPs could be, you know, sort of transitioning to while they're, you know, taking that responsibility of that tier one monitoring off their plate. Because what it often results in, and this is the complaint you'll hear from customers most often, is many, many false positives that result in customers spending hours and hours trying to run down only to find out that it wasn't anything to be concerned about.
Yeah, I mean, I, the funniest description I've heard of that base level SOC work is someone, I won't say who it was, but it was they were saying that it's like, you know, sitting in front of a SIEM console is kind of like Tinder for malicious behavior, you know, yes, no, yes, yes, no, right? Like that's kind of the workflow. And, you know, it's just a recipe for mistakes. So I'd imagine like having something that gives you at least a priority list to work through first before you start going through the manual, you know, process, like might be a good place to start. Now, refresh my memory on how Respond is actually deployed. You know, is it deployed as a SIEM helper into Splunk, or do you actually take a feed of all of the logs into some on-prem equipment yourselves? Like, what is the actual deployment model?
Yeah, we actually have multiple models for deploying the technology. Probably the most common one for us right now is there's an on-premise component called the Respond Analyst Server. And then there is the decision engine, our Respond decision engine, it's in the cloud. You would point your security technologies, your security devices, send those alerts to that on-premise analyst server. And then from there, it talks to our decision engine in the cloud and brings back these decisions. When we see something that's malicious and actionable, right? That's the decision criteria that we're trying to meet. That is the traditional way that we do it. We also offer the ability, instead of forwarding the events from the security devices themselves, we can forward it from the SIM,
Yeah, I was that was exactly what I was going to ask, is if you could just dupe it out of the SIEM, right?
Absolutely, because you know, if a customer is already doing centralized collection and log management, wherever they're doing that, we'll take the feed from that.
Yeah.
And so we built integrations with all the SIEM products, you know, the common ones, as well as you know, data lake type solutions. Wherever you've got it, that's where we want to take it. We can also do the solution full cloud. So you still have to, you know, send us the alerts, whether that's coming from your SIEM or from the security devices, but we could have a, our analyst servers also in the cloud, and you can just do the full cloud approach as well. That's less common. Customers tend to want to have that on-premise component where, you know, they have a little more control over that part of the infrastructure.
Yeah, it makes sense. And I'd imagine the on-prem stuff is doing a lot of stuff like stripping out relevant bits and shunting that up into the cloud rather than the whole kit and caboodle. You do a little bit of sorting on-prem and then shunt the interesting stuff to the cloud. Is that kind of how it works?
We do some sorting on-prem. Yeah, no, that's a great way to say it. Yes.
Okay, exactly, good.
We're extracting what we need to make a good decision. And that's not all the data, right? There's only certain aspects or fields of the security data that we're collecting that we're pulling out and sending. So, yes.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So last time I spoke to someone from Respond, there was like about 10 commonly used technologies that could talk to Respond, and Respond would be able to analyze those logs. I believe really the last year for your company has been about just expanding the number and types of technologies that you're able to actually ingest, right?
Yeah, that is correct. You know, it's a lot of products out there, even in the same category. You know, if you take IDS, IPS as a category, you know, there's a dozen different vendors out there that everyone's using. So if you're going to appeal right to the customer base, you have to have coverage there. And so a lot of the energy has been going into building, you know, the connections to those products, the integrations for all of them across the different categories that we cover.
And is there a particularly popular combination of solutions that vendors tend to come to you with? Like, can you say that Respond works particularly well when you're using technologies X, Y, and Z?
With all the technologies that we, you know, that we have models built for, it just, there's interesting examples when you take, you know, a vendor like a Palo Alto that has the entire security stack in their own product. When we could connect into their full stack, it makes it interesting for any customer that's a Palo Alto shop.
Because
right?
all of a sudden they're getting higher value signaling.
Exactly. And yeah. You know, Palo Alto's been doing very well. I mean, they're very prolific in the market. So for us, it makes sense to make sure that we, you know, will match with their coverage. So that might be one example.
Yeah. So what are some of the newer vendors that you've moved to support over the last 12 months or so?
Well, the thing that we're working on probably the most, I mean, this is not out yet, but on the EDR side, you know, getting the CrowdStrikes, for example, CrowdStrike, Carbon Black, EDR technology has gotten really popular. Everybody's got it deployed. We're still seeing the need to put additional decision logic on top of these feeds to help customers prioritize and understand exactly what's malicious and actionable. So we've been spending a lot of time in that area as of late. The other thing that we've been doing is contextual sources. So being able to ingest DHCP, this is a great feature that we've added so that as IP addresses are, you know, changing inside of an environment, we could keep track of those assets, right? This has proven out to be pretty useful to our clients at this point. Vulnerability scan integration, being able to take vulnerability scan data in as a contextual source in order to make decisions has been, you know, something that's also useful to us.
And that's been one of the holy grails, hasn't it, of security, is being able to tune out like exploitation attempts against stuff that's patched. Like that has been... that's been something people have been trying to do for years, and it's surprisingly hard.
Yeah, you know, the other thing that's cool about vulnerability scan data is that we can infer things like asset criticality from the feed. If we see that there's, you know, server ports are open, you know, you can infer that that's a critical asset, right? It's a server, it's running, you know, different services that are going to be higher criticality than, let's say, a workstation. So you start to get those kinds of advantages, right, when you get that type of feed.
Yeah, that makes sense. That makes a lot of sense, actually. And it's funny, isn't it, that really what we're talking about in a lot of this security automation stuff is we're just talking about taking common sense stuff and automating it. And, you know, this is why I'm very proud of all of you for not trying to go the, whoa, machine learning, artificial intelligence marketing route, right? It's much more about like, oh yeah, okay, that box has ports open. It's on the network and those ports correspond to like a SAP service. We probably want to, you know, pay, you know, escalate alerts targeting that machine a little bit more. I mean, it makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. And, you know, the way that we like to think about it is it's probably not any one approach that's going to win. It's going to be the combination of approaches. You know, we do some ML. That's an aspect of it, right? But that's not the whole thing, right? We leverage Bayesian math. We have probabilistic math as part of our modeling, conditional probabilities. You know, we're leveraging different techniques, sort of, the, you know, the best fit for the problem, right? The best math for the problem is what we say. And we think that's the approach, right? That this that our industry needs to take. It's not going to be, it's going to be a hybrid of sorts in order to get to these answers, because the problems are complex, right? And so, you know, you got to use the right tool for the right problem.
Yeah, it's like, is this an attack? Well, it depends, right? And I'd imagine a lot of the engineering that's gone into Respond would be really just thinking through those curly ones, right? And wondering what context you need to actually make a call on in a given scenario, and then figuring out how to automate that.
Yep. What we're trying to do, and what we're seeing happen, is it, if we can offload this task, what could you do with your time and your budget if you didn't have to spend it on level one SOC analysis, right?
Yeah.
And we start to see how organizations can unlock that budget and apply it to other security projects, which essentially are, you know, things that are going to help reduce risk in an organization, right? And this is where the promise really, really comes, is that when you've got that opportunity and you take it, you take advantage of this, you know, you're able to see that kind of change where you're investigating on average one or two or five alerts a day. I mean, talk to any SOC, they would be so jealous if they had to look at, you know, five incidents that came out of the Respond analyst versus the thousand that they normally have to look at on a daily basis, right?
Yeah.
It changes the game by, you know, orders of magnitude. And it's that kind of change that I think, you know, sort of transforms an industry.
Well, and I think, Chris, one of your best selling points there is, you know, people might be a bit scared of it and say, well, what if we miss something because we're relying on an automated agent? It's like, well, you're missing stuff already, you know, like that's just reality. You know, just because it's in the console, just because it's in the console doesn't mean your level one, like SOC analysts are going to catch it. They're not.
Well, and in fact, the way that our software works is that when we analyze a security event, we're looking at it from dozens of dimensions. We're asking dozens of questions that if a human analyst had the time, the energy, and the skill to ask, that they would on every single alert. So our belief is that we can outperform the human analyst, and you should be asking more, right, the question the other way, right? Not so much as how do you know Respond didn't miss something, but it's how do you know your humans are not missing something? Yeah, they probably are.
That's exactly right. I mean, you know, look, with all of the technology that we feature in Snake Oilers, right? I mean, I've never used Respond software, but it's the sort of thing that, you know, in these sort of conversations, you know, you have convinced me, at least, that it, you know, were I responsible for running a SOC, that it would certainly at least be worth looking into. Chris Triolo, thank you very much for joining us to give us a bit of an update on where Respond is at, and I wish you the best of luck with it.
All right, thank you, Patrick.
That was Chris Triolo there of Respond Software. Big thanks to him for that. And yeah, Respond offers both live trials and historical trials. They're free, where you can just get it to crunch historical logs and compare its output to the things you know were real during that period. Or you can throw it in for a live trial and just have it running in your SOC. And, you know, you can get a really good idea of what sort of outputs, you know, you're going to get out of it. And you have absolutely nothing to lose by at least taking it for a spin. You can check them out at respond-software.com. So that's respond-software.com. And that is it for this edition of the Snake Oilers podcast. I do hope you've enjoyed it. And yeah, I have. I have enjoyed this, right? Which is kind of not what I expected when I started doing these sponsored podcasts a couple of years ago. I mean, there was a part of me when I launched this series that felt like I was a massive sellout. But God help me, I actually enjoy doing these. I enjoy the conversations. 90% of the vendors who participate are really smart and super cool to deal with. So yeah, not what I expected when I started off doing this. We will be running a Soapbox edition next week from Yubico, which is another fantastic podcast, chatting with their CTO all about their latest line of YubiKeys and you know, where they're going. That's super cool. And then in 2 weeks from now, we'll be dropping part two of this Snake Oilers edition. But that is it from me this week. Until next week, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.